Festive snuggle fucks.
That's so accurate. We really are a bunch of festive fucking snuggle fucks, aren't we?
We are.
Dude, you haven't been on in a minute, man.
Exactly a year.
Oh my god, to the day, I wonder.
Not quite. I think next week would be to the day.
I think it's like the 12th, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know why I know that, but...
You know, I must say, too, about that show in particular, that is one of the most memorable shows, especially lately as we're approaching.
We quote that show all the time.
You little bitch! And obviously, if you don't remember, too, I hadn't seen the whole movie all the way through before. So, yeah, for me, it's like an instant classic.
And history is going to repeat itself with this as well, because Dan hadn't seen this movie all the way through either.
Nope. Yep. Never is one of my weak spots, so coming full circle here, cutting the chase.
Well, we got two little segments here for you. We started doing, if you hadn't been asked questions from us before, we started doing that like back on the Leprechaun shows. So we have some questions for you, and then I have another little fun game before we get into the review.
Let's do it.
All right. This segment is called 5 Questions for Rosie Venom Hands. I thought it was clever.
Wow.
All right, Venom. How... Fuck.
You had to explain it to me.
I did. He was like, what is Rosie Venom Hands? I was like, you know, Rosie Palmer and her 5 friends. He goes, oh, fuck.
I was like, that's pretty good.
I know. All right, so question number 1. Have you ever had a Christmas miracle?
Nothing that I would classify as a miracle, no. But I do remember when I was a little kid, I'm from Spain, for anyone who doesn't know.
I didn't know that.
One Christmas, really? I'd say probably like, I was probably somewhere in the 8 to 10 year old range. We went to Spain for the Christmas season. And I remember worrying that Santa wasn't going to leave me anything because I was in a whole other country. So obviously, you know, my parents did the cool thing and they brought some of my gifts to Spain with us so that I was still able to have a traditional Christmas morning. But then when we flew back home on January 4th, I walk into my living room and what do I see? A whole nother set of gifts under the tree. I'm like, all right, that's about as close to a miracle as I could possibly imagine.
Right?
You gotta hook the fuck up.
Yeah, it was pretty decent.
Nice. I thought you were going to say that one elusive Christmas where Mike Merriman actually stayed up long enough. That was the Christmas miracle.
Has that happened?
I don't think so.
No.
All right. Question number 2. What was your biggest Christmas disaster?
Biggest Christmas disaster. Okay. I'm going to say... One year when I was, this was probably right out of high school, but before I started college. I didn't start college right away out of high school. I took a couple of years off. During that time, I started dating a girl, and I wasn't, how can I put it? I wasn't the most loving gift giver. Somebody might say, you might even call me a little selfish, because basically what I did was I bought this girl, who, mind you, is not a metalhead. I bought her two tickets to the Pantera and Sepultura concert, knowing who she was going to be, of course. I bought her like two or three horror movies. Mind you, she doesn't watch horror. I bought her a couple of horror movies on VHS, because that was the cool thing back in 91. Mm-hmm. And I forget what else I got her, but I got her something else, like a gift certificate to a place that she would never go to, but I would always go to. And I just remember thinking, as I was giving her these gifts, it literally hit me as she's opening them, holy shit, I'm an asshole. Every fucking gift I got her was really for me, and I'm like, I am never fucking doing that again, and I have not. To this day, I won't even buy my wife like a movie or an album or anything that we both like. She has to be the one who likes it, and that's what I get. Because now it's just, and of course now I'm an adult with a good job, so I can buy my own shit anyway. But obviously that year I took advantage of Christmas and just spent my money basically on myself.
I love that story,
though. That is probably, like.
So I take it she did not grow up to be Mrs. Venom then.
Believe it or not, we were engaged a couple of years after that. I popped the question. She was the first woman that I popped the question to. Yep. And we probably stayed engaged, I don't know, maybe a little less than a year before it all fell apart.
How was the Pantera concert?
That was spectacular, actually.
Oh, right.
And for whatever it's worth, she did end up having a good time. Not necessarily because she liked the music, but because I was buying her drinks all night and getting her stoned. And you know, we just ended up having a blast, even though she didn't give a rat fuck about any of those bands.
Right.
So it was more of a Christmas disaster for her.
Yeah, kind of, now that I think
about it. Yeah, he made it. Oh, great.
So
what do you mean?
So even your, even the answer to your question was selfish. It was even a disaster for you. It was a disaster for somebody.
I know what he means, though, because I've done that for my brother. Like, I remember having, you know, Sega, and yeah, like, I'd buy him a game knowing damn well
that, you would get to play.
That I would have full access. So it was basically just buying myself a game. Yeah. Yep. So I feel you on that one, Mr. Brenham.
All right. That was a great answer. I love it.
Yeah, that was good.
What do you think is the worst Christmas-themed movie of all time? Ooh. Or one that just annoys you? Or it could be any genre, but it has to be Christmas-themed.
I think I know this.
What?
Oh, okay. I might surprise you, because I hate this movie. And it's more because of where I was when the movie came out. But I got to go with Home Alone. I have always hated that movie. Now, I will fully admit I haven't watched it in probably a good 10 to 15 years, so maybe I'll soften up to it if I were to watch it again. If Mrs. Venom wanted to watch it, I would happily watch it with her. It's not a big deal.
Okay, I have to know then. What is the story behind that? Why?
Yeah. Like, when that movie came out, I was one of those, how can I put it? One of those, like, sulking, douchebag metalheads who thought anything that people
after the failed engagement.
This would have been, what year was Home Alone? Shit.
I think like 93.
Okay, then it was, so it would have been just before I met Mrs. Venom, probably the year before. Anyway, yeah, so it was after the breakup with my first fiance, and I just remember, like, that whole Christmas season that year, right. I just had no desire to celebrate, no desire to be festive, no desire to buy anybody a gift, nothing. And I just... I just remember not caring. I remember waking up Christmas morning, and it was just another day to me, other than there were decorations up.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you say that, because, you know, generally, like even you said in the intro, you snuggle fucks. You know, we try to embrace the holidays, and obviously, you know, we try and maximize and try and get as much fun out of it as possible, because I know for me, like, not every Christmas has been great. Like, some of them have completely just fucking sucked for whatever reason, you know? And so I think that's why you try and celebrate when, you know, things are finally going somewhat good in your life, you know, with COVID standing, obviously. But, you know, you try and just make the best out of out of each situation. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that year. Oh, that year was also the year after my parents divorced. So it was the first Christmas where it was just my mother and I. So, yeah, my mother's never been the most festive person. She'll do it. She'll do the holiday when the family's all together and everything else. And she's remarried since then, and her new husband had a couple of kids from a previous marriage. So she's got that big family that she can have Christmas with now. But, yeah, that year,
that's awesome.
Just neither one of us really were in the Christmas spirit.
An only child?
I am.
I did not know that.
So is Mrs. Venom.
Oh, yeah? Oh, wow. Yeah.
Well, that makes sense to why your presents were selfish.
Yeah, right?
Like, it all makes sense. Like, I feel like I know you on a completely different level after these questions. I didn't know, it would go this, in-depth.
I didn't know he was from Spain. I didn't know the Home Alone thing. Like, I'm learning so much.
I didn't know there was a almost Mrs. Venom.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. Almost Mrs. Venom Part 1. Yep. I ended up marrying the sequel.
All right. Next question. All right. What are your top three Christmas songs?
Christmas songs. Okay.
Yeah. Ones that you don't mind listening to or don't annoy you.
I'm gonna go a little off the rails here. Number one, King Diamond, No Presents for Christmas.
Oh, you son of a bitch.
Number two, what was that? God damn it. We could throw a Little Drummer Boy in there because I've always been a fan of that song. Something about the simplistic, music and, the very somber tone has always worked for me.
There's some cool renditions of it out there, too.
Absolutely.
Like that intro?
Like Dan's?
That's not my favorite, so yeah.
Sweet.
That was a big fan of. And, honestly, anything that Bing Crosby sings, I can get into. My mother was a huge Bing Crosby fan, especially all his Christmas music, so pretty much.
Earth. Huh? Like Peace on Earth.
Yeah, White Christmas. I mean, he has multiple albums of just Christmas music. Right. He even did a lot of the Christmas songs in the Rankin Bass Christmas specials, like Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Like, that's Bing Crosby singing those songs. So,
right.
That's awesome.
Right. Yeah, and I think with Christmas music too, I don't know. Me personally, I can consume it, but it has to be in moderation. When I start hearing it, a couple months out, when they start jamming it in November,
before Thanksgiving.
Especially in the radio stations, even, they just don't give a fuck. They're like, nope, we're just going full fucking speed ahead. So it's like, okay. But then you get to listen to it for 2 months that, it does kind of burn you out. But I know we kind of, learned that with Halloween, too, where, you can't blow your load too early, and you definitely, you got to kind of pace yourself. And I found with especially Christmas music, I have to do that because if I get inundated with it, I just shut down. I'm like, all right, this is now annoying. And it starts, with the shopping and all the bullshit pressure that comes along with Christmas, it starts to get
you only
to me
have
sometimes.
To shop for one person.
This year is great. No, this year I'm not stressed at all. Not even a little bit. Especially now, and you mentioned this on the previous show, but online shopping now just makes things so easy.
Yeah. It really does.
So fucking easy. So, yeah, that's a big aspect that's changed for me.
For me with music, I used to, just loathe it. We used to have, these Christmas concerts, when I was a kid. Up on the house, or up on the rooftop, click, click, click. Down to the chimney when good Saint Nick, and you have to do the motions and shit, and it was so stupid. And you're standing on these risers, and your parents have their video cameras out, and I just remember I was this sucks. I couldn't sing, and it was stupid. So I hated Christmas music after that.
Right.
But this sometimes you'll catch me in it. I like certain songs, but this year I'm kind of embracing it.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Especially with, doing these intros because everybody gets a Christmas song themed to them for the intros. So I'm having a lot of fun with it this year. So
nice. Oh, I just thought of two more. I don't think I actually completed my three. Just for comedic value, I gotta give a shout out to Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. I fucking love that song. I don't care how stupid it is. I remember hearing it the year it came out, and my father and I just absolutely had a blast. It was like we were smoking a joint or something. We were laughing so hard. Yeah. And then the other one is Run DMC, Christmas in Hollis.
Oh, snap. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Even though I'm not much of a hip-hop guy, and most people know that, that song, you know, it's from either late 80s or early 90s, so it just kind of hit with me at the time.
Right on, man. I like all those answers.
Me too. All right, we got one more question for you, and it's the infamous fuck, marry, kill. All right, since we're going to keep it themed to this episode, we're going to stick with Winona Ryder rules.
Yeah.
So, fuck, marry, kill, Winona and Heathers as Veronica, Lydia in Beetlejuice, or her character in Reality Bites. I think her name was Sarah, if I'm not mistaken.
Is that four versions?
No, it's three.
Oh. That's all three.
I could be wrong. What's her name?
Unfortunately, I remember nothing about Reality Bites. I've only seen it the one time. I took my girlfriend at the time to see it in theaters. It didn't leave much of an impression on me. So
well,
I never
you know what? Fine. We're going to take her out, and we're going to give you...
Stranger Things,
yep,
Winona
that's
Ryder.
Exactly where I was going with that.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's interesting. That's even better. Okay. Let's see. I am going to marry Lydia Deetz because I love goth chicks. I am going to kill Stranger Things' mom because she annoys the hell out of me. And I'm going to... What was the third one? Oh, Heathers, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I definitely fucked the hell out of her.
From that. Makes sense.
Yeah, she's definitely
the attitude,
fuckable. Oh,
the attitude she has by the end of the movie. It's like, oh, I want to do things to you.
Now, out of all the Heathers in that movie, which one would you have preferred?
Oh, of the real Heathers? Not
yeah,
counting,
not Veronica. Or are you a Betty Finn kind of guy?
Nah. who drank the orange juice?
That wasn't...
I remember her being pretty attractive.
Yeah, she actually died at a really early age.
Oh, the actress?
Yeah, like she died like a couple years after the movie, I think.
Wow.
She had like throat cancer or something, I'm not sure. Or pancreatitis. She had something that went like really... She died really early. Her name... She wasn't Heather McNamara. That was the cheerleader.
Yeah, definitely not the cheerleader. Because I remember she drank the juice and then she passed out face forward. Why face not? First.
I love that movie. It's one of my all-time favorites.
Heathers is great.
Yeah. Well, we do have one more segment before we get into our feature review.
Yes.
And this one is, everybody kind of gets to play a fun little game with us. Because, I mean, holidays are about getting together with your friends and having some fucking fun, right?
Playing Candyland and shit.
No. All right, this segment is called Cut the Shit. Name that Christmas gift. I don't know. So you have to name, or I'm going to give you the description of a Christmas gift that was given, and you have to name the movie that it came from.
Gotcha.
Okay. All right, number one, a wooden pickle.
A wooden pickle. By the way, are these all Christmas movies?
They are.
Okay. Not right. necessarily.
What do you mean?
No.
Okay. What do you mean?
No.
Well, this one is.
A lot of them are. I have like two that are like questionable.
Oh, and Mr. Venom, you can ask for a clue.
Yeah, and Dan will give you the clue.
Yes.
Go ahead. I would love a clue for a wooden pickle.
Okay. We covered this year on 12 Days of Christmas.
This year, as in 2020?
Yes. Yes.
I'm gonna say Bad Santa.
Oh, yes.
Nice.
Yep, that is correct, sir. One for one.
All right. Are you, like, really good with Christmas movies? Do you watch a lot of Christmas movies?
Honestly, I don't. I'm better with Christmas specials, like, you know, the classic, you know, Charlie Brown and all the Rankin Bass stuff, and even, like, series like, you know, Roseanne's Christmas special or, you know, obviously Simpsons and stuff like that. But when it comes to Christmas movies, I mean, I will fully admit I am... Over the course of my life, I'm definitely more of a Scrooge than a happy Christmas camper. So when it comes to movies, it's like I really, really got to be in the mood for it. I think the last non-horror Christmas movie that I watched was probably Jingle All the Way a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Put that cookie down.
Put that cookie down. All right. Well, you might. I think a lot of these are like well known, so.
I hope so.
You know, pop culture. Are you like? Aren't you in the trivia champion?
I am still. I mean, if we're still doing it, yes, I am one of the four semifinalists.
He's like, yeah, horror trivia, not.
Yeah, exactly.
Big fucking difference.
Which is funny because Venom is the only one to do. He did Cut to the Chasemus last year, and now he's doing 12 Days of Chasemus this year.
Yep.
Which we only put out 2 episodes last year, so.
We're already fucking
So we definitely have a tradition going on here with Venom.
Right?
We got we got a fucking Christmas tradition.
There it is, baby.
There you go.
Hanging on the tree.
All right, Venom.
Yes.
What movie was this gift given in? A towel.
Scrooged.
See? I thought we'd throw it back.
And I think he's going to do good. Even though he said he's not the biggest Christmas fan, I think he's going to do good on all these.
Yeah?
Yeah, he's 2 for 2.
2 for 2. All right, I think he's definitely going to get this one.
Okay.
A Red Ryder BB gun.
Oh, well, of course, the classic Christmas story.
Lay up. See, I think you're more...
Pop culturally Christmas known.
Than he's letting on, yes.
I think so, too.
Yes. I mean, maybe. Who knows? I would never give myself credit for being a Christmas movie expert.
Maybe you're a Christmas gift movie expert.
There we go.
All right. The next one is a talk boy.
A what? A
talk boy. Do you not Google?
No. I'm not Googling. I'm not even... Spell that for me.
A talk boy. Like
talk. Okay.
Talk boy. It was a talk I should say. Boy.
You just about gave away the answer.
Oh, man. I'm going to need a hint on that one.
The hint is this movie is a sequel.
Talk Boy. I wish I knew what a Talk Boy was.
Oh, well, I think we can tell him that.
It's something that you talk into and like it'll play back.
It's like a video recorder.
It's like a recorder.
In the 90s.
Talk Boy. For some reason, it sounds like that thing that Homer gave Bart in that one Simpsons episode. I'm sure that's not it, but...
No, it's a movie.
Yeah.
I'm going to give a major, major clue here.
Uh-oh.
You don't like the original movie.
I don't like the original. Wow. You guys are stumping me.
What do you mean? You literally just fucking said it.
Wait, what? I did...
You literally just told us about 10 minutes ago that you hated this movie, the original.
Oh, well, you don't have to give me credit for this one since you gave me so many clues. But yeah, I guess it's Home Alone.
Part 2.
Oh, that one I've never even seen.
I thought we were giving him a softball, but apparently Mr. Venom needs a T-ball.
I thought for sure that was a layup.
I'm just playing.
Yeah, never seen that one.
All right. Well,
that would make sense with his answer earlier, though.
Well, he can redeem himself here.
All right. An oversized joint.
Oh.
Oversized joint. Is that Harold and Kumar?
Yes! Fuck yes.
A subscription to Jelly of the Month Club.
Oh shit. Oh, I know this.
I love hearing them squirm.
Right?
Oh yeah.
I like, get such pleasure out of this.
Jelly of the Month Club, god damn it. I'll take a shot in the dark and just say Christmas Vacation.
Yeah!
What, are you kidding? Holy shit.
The quintessential Christmas movie, but from a lot of people.
Yeah, go with that.
Do you actually like that one, Venom?
Yes, I enjoy the original better, more, but I mean, obviously as a Christmas film, it's great.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely a fan. Mrs. Venom, too, loves that movie.
Right on.
All right, this one might be tough, I don't know.
Uh-oh.
A TV dinner.
A TV dinner.
You told me this answer, and I'm blanking again.
Well, you've only seen this movie for the first. I made you watch it this year.
Oh,
dinner shit. I don't know. You got a hint for me?
Yes. It is not a Christmas. It is technically not a Christmas movie, but it's a classic 80s comedy.
Who the fuck gives a TV dinner as a gift?
Right. That's what I said.
Would you like a quote from the movie?
Yeah, why not?
Gee, Ricky, I'm sorry your mom blew up.
What the hell? That sounds familiar, too, and I'm just blinded. What is going on?
So bad he missed this one.
I probably will, yeah. Yeah, I give up. I got no idea.
This one is from Better Off Dead.
Another movie I haven't seen in like 20 years. But I do love that movie, though. I remember absolutely loving it.
Yeah, and you know, John Cusack actually hates that movie. He's like, it's the stupidest fucking movie I've ever done.
Well, there's just a lot of things about John Cusack that,
that I don't like.
Right.
All right. Turbo Man.
Oh, Jingle All the Way.
Yes.
All right, and we got one more for you. All right, the last question is a carton of cigarettes.
The Breakfast Club.
Yes!
Oh!
Do you know the quote?
What was it? Dad gave me a pack of cigarettes and said, smoke them up, buddy, or something like that.
You know what I got for Christmas? It was a banner year at the old Bender house. You want to know what I got for Christmas? You want to know what my old man got me for Christmas? A carton of cigarettes. He said, smoke them up, Johnny! Classic.
Yes.
I got to watch that again, too. I haven't watched that in a couple years.
Oh, there's just so much fun.
Oh, absolutely.
That was really fun watching you, or listening to you squirm.
I was at work the other day.
Oh, you should have seen it. I'm sure it was hysterical.
This dude quoted The Breakfast Club, and this, and he's just like, you know, from The Breakfast Club, and this younger dude is just like, oh, yeah, no, I've never seen it. And the stare that this guy gave this kid. he goes, oh, wow. He was so taken back by it.
All right, guys, we are going to get into our feature review of one of my personal favorites. I mean, we're doing classics here. I mean, they're pretty much widely loved or hated in some cases. Well, I don't know what Venom's take is on this. I don't know if he loves it or hates it, so we're going to find out. But I'm going to read the synopsis from IMDb.
If I know Mr. Venom, he does not fucking hate this.
No, he wanted to marry Lydia Deetz. So.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. So the description from IMDb is sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong.
Most of the time, wrong.
All right. An artificial man who was incompletely constructed has scissors for hands, leads a solitary life. Then one day, a suburban lady meets him and introduces him to her world.
All right.
You're welcome for that narration there. I mean, that's
really.
And all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse.
Now, I got a question for Mr. Venom. In general, you know, from beginning to end, his whole entire career, what's your take on Tim Burton? Do you like him?
I'm going to say I loved him in the first half of his career. And then in the second half of his career, he did the quality of his films maybe wasn't as consistent. Like the fantastic appeal of them, almost the dreamlike state in a lot of his early films. I feel like his later films lost that
Dumbo.
A little bit. I mean, Dumbo, Alice in Wonderland. I mean, and Alice in Wonderland isn't a terrible movie, either one of them. But
Alice in Wonderland's like a C.
Yeah, at best, yeah.
Dumbo just barely feels Tim Burton-ish.
Really? Yeah,
like barely. It's like there's like, I don't know if he's gone like too mainstream with like doing, you know, classic stories and he's not really like doing his own thing.
Right.
You know, because when we were watching last night, Edward Scissorhands, you know, we made the comment like he likes to see his own name because it popped up like, 5 times in a row in the credits.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I haven't seen that a whole lot in a lot of other films.
Right,
like,
right.
To where, Tim Burton produced, Tim Burton wrote and directed, Tim Burton did this, this. I just contributed the whole damn movie.
Right. Well, and at this time, though, this is when he was in his groove, you know, and there's so many different ways you could kind of describe his style. It's kind of, obviously, you know, gothic and you know, that, but it's also, like you said too, sort of fantastical. And I think that, you know, when he was doing movies around this time, I don't know, he really tapped into something really cool.
Special.
But then you look at movies that came later and you know, look at like the type of movies that are inspired by Tim Burton movies, like Cat in the Hat, and just really odd pieces of art, like very just weird interpretations of things, and it never just quite gels. It never feels like cool. And I remember when I was, you know, I there were definitely movies that I missed in full earlier on,
like
that
Beetlejuice?
I've since, like Beetlejuice and stuff like that. But when I watch Beetlejuice, like, I remember it having a very distinct impression on me. And I also remember being a huge Batman fan, so when he kind of put his stamp on that, you felt those movies as well. Like, those Tim Burton Batmans feel like Tim Burton's Batman. Like, that is Tim Burton's Gotham. And, you know, it's funny, like I said about those imitators, they tried to recreate his world,
mm-hmm.
you know, with Joel Schumacher and mm-hmm. these directors afterwards. And look at what it turned into. And it was just like, wow. Like, and, like, just by getting it wrong, look how disastrous it can be. So, I don't know. I always thought that Tim Burton...
I had fun with those movies.
I have fun with them, too. I'm just saying that, like, you can't not look back at them and know that they're fucking not batshit crazy. But
yeah.
But the thing, no pun intended, by the way. But, no, I just love Tim Burton. And, like I said, I had seen parts of this movie before, but never front to back all the way through. And I think that, you know, watching it for the first time, that distinct stamp that he put on, you know, his films around that time period, that is very apparent here, and I think this is one of his best.
Absolutely, yeah. Going back to to his early career, though, one of the things that I used to say early on about Tim Burton is that I loved a lot of his 80s and 90s films because they felt like live-action cartoons. Think
yes.
about Beetlejuice, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Ed Wood, Batman, Mars Attacks. Those are basically comic book stories brought to life on celluloid. But he has this great art design with his films that gives it
yes.
that sense of not quite reality, you know? Like,
right.
like Gotham is obviously solidly Tim Burton's Gotham, but there's a
mm-hmm.
quality to it that it doesn't quite feel real. But
right.
it's real enough to enjoy the film. It's got that, you know, that comic book art quality to it. Pee-wee's
yep.
Big Adventure, to me, basically is a cartoon. I mean, that's a cartoon, basically. With all of its effects and, you know, all the crazy adventures that Pee-wee goes on. I mean, that's a perfect example of Burton of doing live-action cartoon-style cinema. And I absolutely loved it.
It's one of my favorite movies, Pee-wee.
I'd probably say either Mars Attacks or Sleepy Hollow was the last of his movies to really have that feel to it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. They say Sweeney Todd, I think, is... I mean, I'm not a fan. I haven't seen it, so I can't really say. I just never seen the appeal. But
right.
by looking at it, it looks Tim Burton-ish to me. Like, I can just look at it and tell it's Tim Burton. But they say, you know, his downfall
mm-hmm.
was having... his wife in it.
Oh, Helena Bonham Carter. Mm. Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know. Whatever. Like, we all, if anybody's a Kevin Smith fan, and I'm sure Venom knows what I'm talking about,
yeah.
Kevin Smith tells the story of Bumble Ward, of Tim Burton's assistant, Bumble Ward, and just the interactions that he had with him. He's clearly a fucking strange dude. I don't know. I don't know what it is that made him change. You could definitely point to that for sure. All I know is, you know, the specific taste that I like, it was definitely earlier Tim Burton, for
yeah.
sure. And I will agree about Sleepy Hollow, too. I love that movie.
I've
is
never
incredible.
Seen it.
Oh, my God. It's incredible. I love
great
it.
Great movie.
Yeah.
I mean,
Christopher Walken?
Yes.
Yes. It's a great movie. I mean, it's got some awesome violence to it, but it's almost like it's a horror movie that you can still watch with a slightly younger audience, because even though there's a lot of decapitations, there's not necessarily a lot of blood and gore. So,
is that a Halloween movie?
It's a step up from like Hocus Pocus, you know, maybe
the story,
two.
The story of Ichabod Crane doesn't occur on Halloween, but over the years, it's been adopted as a Halloween movie, specifically because Disney, back in the 60s, they would actually air that on television with Mr. Toad's Wild Ride on Halloween or around Halloween. So it just kind of became a Halloween tradition, even though it's technically not set on Halloween.
Right.
Venom, yep. How do you store all your knowledge?
Yeah, seriously.
Oh, it's just because I'm old. Trust me. It's got nothing to do with brain power. When you get old, you just remember the dumbest things sometimes.
That's not dumb. I find it fascinating.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Now, all right, so we've talked Tim Burton. Let's talk the cast before we get into, like, the plot.
Yes.
And, you know, let's talk about the casting of this. You got, you know, a young Winona Ryder. You got a young Johnny Depp. You got, you know, the mom from Lost Boys, Diane Weist.
Weist.
You have Alan Arkin. You have the biggest nerd from the 1980s, you know, Anthony Michael Hall.
Ugh.
You have... You have the little boy from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids that Dan mentioned. I didn't even realize it was the same kid. I don't know.
Is it that we never confirmed that? But that's definitely him, right?
It's him. French class.
Yes.
You know, and there's just so like the core characters in this. I mean, there's like a lot of side characters as well, but for the core characters, how do you feel about the casting of this film?
The casting here is near perfect when it comes to Vincent Price's role. Johnny Depp's role, Anthony Michael Hall's role, hell, even Joyce, Kathy Baker. I mean, I thought they all did stellar jobs. I think the dad would probably be the only one that isn't perfect. It's great. Don't get me wrong. I'm not talking any smack about the role or the actor. I'm just saying I think I could think of maybe one or two actors that might have been able to play the cynical dad a little bit more comedically. Let me think. Back in 1990, he's probably way too old. Somebody like a Walter Matthau, but he would have been like in his 60s, so way too old for that role.
I don't know why, but my head went to Bob Saget.
Ooh.
I don't know. I was thinking 90s. He was the first.
What about you said Walken before? What about a Christopher Walken?
In that particular role, I don't think would have worked.
I can see him in this world.
Absolutely. Oh, definitely.
All I can see is him doing heroin in Little Miss Sunshine.
Alan Arkin.
Yes. Oh, man.
Well, it's weird that he had so much hair in this.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I think I have a weird thing with people that used to have hair that don't anymore.
That's fucked up, baby. Well, don't laugh at that, Venom. What the fuck?
Come on. It's not a cut to the chase up. I don't get one bald joke in.
One? Okay.
But, yeah, so did you like the casting of the dad?
I think I get what Mr. Venner was saying. There was one point when he was running away and the dad was on the roof and he had said something nonchalantly to him.
It's like, Edward, where are you going?
Yeah, I felt that was a little, I don't know if it was just the way it was written or whatever, but there was something about that that kind of, not rubbed me the wrong way, but it just felt a little out of place. But overall, yeah, the cast is fucking phenomenal. I know, you know, as soon as you start seeing Johnny Depp do his thing, because, you know, you flash forward to Alice in Wonderland and, you know, he's obviously worked with Burton on many occasions that they're known for working together, right? Nice. But to see kind of, you know, the origins of that and you see what they saw in each other, if that makes sense. And they were definitely not only on the same page, but they just made a really good team. Mm-hmm. You know, talk about the physical nature of Edward and just the way he moves and how he's doing. So technically, yeah, he talks very minimally, but a lot of it's, you know, the facial work going on and his mannerisms. And I just thought that Johnny Depp did so fucking well. You know, you could have just chalked this up, this performance up to, oh, it's very Tim Burton-y or whatever. When you're watching him, it's fascinating. Like, I can't watch anything else on screen but how he's reacting and what's going on.
I just got really emotional just thinking about, I'm sorry, I don't know.
Well, I mean, his performance, especially his nonverbal performance, it's very emotional yet humorous at times, you know? I mean, you can see the sadness in his eyes, but then when he smiles, there's like a weird, there's like an oddness to his smile, because obviously he's not used to smiling. It's not something that he's done a lot by himself in his castle for the last however many years. So,
right.
So you can tell that it's foreign to him, that being happy, being around people, it's all so foreign to him, and he's able to express that without using any words. So, right. Yeah, absolutely. And what's funny, too, is that you were just talking about Burton and Johnny Depp, like, you know, working together and how Burton has the confidence in him. Believe it or not, Tim Burton did not want Johnny Depp to play Edward Scissorhands. From the information that I found, Johnny Depp was the seventh choice to play this role. Do you guys know any of the people that were up for the role?
No. What a who?
Okay.
Like,
everyone's
gonna fuck up my world.
Right?
Some of them might, yeah. Tim Burton's first choice was Gary Oldman. Unfortunately, Gary Oldman. That was his first choice. Unfortunately, Gary Oldman was a big enough star at the time that he commanded too much money.
Right.
And he ended up passing on it and going to do what? Like True Romance or something
True
like
Romance,
that.
True Romance, right. Well, he's phenomenal. You can't fuck with Gary Oldman.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
Right. And then the next few choices are Tom Hanks, Jim Carrey.
Okay.
Jim Carrey was that. And this is Jim Carrey in Living Color. So he literally would have been a no-name. Robert Downey Jr. was another choice of his. And that's because Less Than Zero is one of Tim Burton's favorite movies.
Mine as well.
Yeah, Robert Downey Jr. was another choice of his. And then this is one that's going to make your fucking head spin. Michael Jackson.
Oh, dude, I can totally see that, though.
Especially with the wardrobe.
You know what, though? All of those that you just said, like, I can see it.
I don't know if I could see... I don't know if I could see Gary Oldman doing it, honestly.
Gary Oldman can do anything.
What,
he's
you mean,
amazing.
Like, voice Tao?
Yeah, but, okay. Listen.
You're welcome.
All I'm saying... is wait till you see Gary Oldman in Hannibal.
Okay, I haven't seen it. So.
Amazing.
And then the last choice, this one wasn't Tim Burton's choice. This was the studio. The actual studio wanted this guy, Mr. Tom Cruise. And the studio, they actually approached him multiple times. The studio, at this point, don't forget, 1990, Tom Cruise was like bigger than shit. I mean, he was the biggest star in the world.
Right.
And again,
he was the Top Gun.
Exactly.
Wow.
The reason that Tom Cruise said no to the role is because he didn't like the ending. He actually said he didn't want to do the movie if it was going to have a sad ending like that. So, and Tim Burton stuck to his guns and said, "I'm not changing the ending for anybody." So good. Tom Cruise ended up walking.
Well,
I can't picture anybody other than Johnny Depp as Edward Scissorhands. Like, I can see, like, the potential.
Right.
But I'm sorry, Johnny Depp just is Edward Scissorhands. Like, I think everything happens for a rhyme and a reason.
Right.
I don't know how they came across Johnny Depp. Like, I didn't do, like, research on that at all whatsoever. I probably should have, but do you know how he got the role of Venom?
Actually, after Tom Cruise was the sixth person to say no to the role, somebody on his production team actually mentioned Johnny Depp. And in 1990... I don't believe Johnny Depp had done any movies yet. All he had done was 21 Jump Street.
Nightmare
on Elm Street.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Totally forgot about Nightmare.
Yeah, and isn't that funny, too, because he's Edward Scissorhands.
And he's such a preppy boy
In that opening scene, though, when she first comes up to Edward when she's selling...
Avon,
yes. When she rolls up to him, he looks like a Freddy Krueger, like in the shadows. Like, I was like, that's a really cool image right there. And you can say that about Tim Burton, the whole movie, really. Like, I love it. It's
such a world.
It's so, even there's shots in the house where the camera, it's set up in such a weird way that, especially now, you see that duplicated so much. And you know, you got to give Tim Burton so much credit, because not only was he like a pioneer in that sense, like he was really groundbreaking. He was really groundbreaking in a lot of ways, I think. And visually, even when it came to like Suburbia, I love the way it was kind of portrayed. You know, it's like, it's almost like a dreamlike state at times.
You know, it's funny because you were like, when we were throwing out recommendations, like, I love this movie. It's one of my favorites of all time.
Yeah.
I said to Dan, I was like, we should do that for the 12 Days of Chasemus. And he was just like, not a Christmas movie. It feels like a summer movie. And, you know, watching it back, like, it does kind of feel, like, summery. That's why, like, I get kind of confused of, like, how much time, like, he's actually down there with them.
Okay, I'll say this. Now, we talked about this earlier. How much Christmas does it have to be? I think some of those things earlier where, you know, like, say, like, Mean Girls or whatever, right? I don't consider that a Christmas movie. That's a piece in the movie or whatever.
They have Halloween in it, too.
With this in particular, I think that when she picks up the, oh, you're going to a Christmas party, and it's
the
kind
last
of,
act is yeah. Straight Christmas.
And one of the plot points, kind of, and where the emotion comes from has to do with snow, which kind right. of coincides with Christmas as well. If you can make that correlation, and I know I can very easily, if you can make that jump, then it's easily a Christmas movie because it's emotionally hinged on something that has to do with the holiday.
Absolutely. I can't disagree with that at all.
Yeah. So.
But yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people might not consider it a Christmas movie because unfortunately, I mean, it's an hour and 45 minute movie. And the very first sign of Christmas is at the 1 hour and 15 minute point. So like Lacey right. said, the whole third act is basically Christmas. So for me, that's plenty. I accept that. Yeah. Absolutely. But I have heard people make the argument that no, the whole movie has to take place in December or whatever. I'm like, no, come on.
But see, the thing is, though, like Dan made a good point. You know, does correlate with the snow. So, like, obviously, like, you know that it was around, you know, December when this is happening. So I'm assuming that they probably lived in some place really warm, like Florida or California.
Something like that.
You know, in suburbia.
Yeah. The movie was shot in Tampa. And I don't think they actually make her in Florida in the movie. But because of the whole thing with, you know, it never snowed before Edward came down from the mountain, right. I it's pretty much assumed, yeah. I mean, since
it's
I don't see any palm trees, I don't think it's California, so I tend to lean towards Florida.
Yeah, like, yep. I mean, just the look of, like, the Technicolor, or,
yep.
It feels very Floridian.
And what's funny, too, is that neighborhood was not painted for the movie. That's a neighborhood
really?
That Tim Burton actually found while traveling through Tampa, and he said it reminded him of his childhood in Burbank, with all the houses being a different color on the street. So he just decided right then and there, we're shooting the movie in this neighborhood. So, yeah, a little more trivia.
That's perfect. Nice.
Yeah, no, right that's on. Really cool. And I love how, like, it transcends from dark to light.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And then back to dark. Like, this movie has, like, so many different, like, you know, messages and themes throughout it.
Oh, this movie is thick with social commentary.
Yeah.
Well, can I ask you guys a question, too? Because I don't know much about this movie and its intent. I don't know if it was meant, but it was giving me Frankenstein vibes, obviously, right?
You can go with Frankenstein, you can go with Pinocchio.
Right.
You could go with, what am I thinking of? There was an old movie from, like, the 50s called A Stranger in a Strange Land, where it wasn't a comedy or horror or anything, but it was kind of the same premise, where somebody found
right.
this kid living by himself. They tried to indoctrinate him into the real world. It obviously didn't
right.
work. I think that was the name of the movie, Stranger in a Strange Land, something like that. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of homages in this movie. I mean, you could tell that Tim Burton himself is a cinephile. With
yeah,
all
oh, absolutely.
Inspiration, you know?
And I feel like the whole thing of just, it's so simple. Like, I say it, and I feel like because it sounds so simple, me saying it, it should take away, but it doesn't take away from it at all. But it's just, you know, the outsider aspect, you know? And you can't help but love this guy. He's got no, you know, he's obviously has a moral compass, and he has a heart. we had to make that clear. I was like, did he get a heart? You're like, what the fuck do you mean, baby? Of course you got a heart. If you didn't have a heart, he'd be alive. I'm like, I'm sorry. I thought.
Well, he's like, he said he was incomplete. I was like,
he said he was
fucking
incomplete.
Hands.
So I didn't know if the moral of the fucking movie was going to be like, he got a heart, like the Tin Man.
This isn't the Grinch. This isn't the Wizard of Oz.
That's true. Yeah. No, but I just love the whole outsider and, you know, just kind of the social commentary on that and, how everybody. Hey, charge for your hedge, and, like, all these things that come up in a very Tim Burton-y way.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, what's funny is that as a minority, I have a love-hate relationship with this movie. I absolutely love it. It's a beautiful film. It's almost perfect. But obviously, when I watch everything that Edward goes through, I feel his frustration because that's, and you know, I'm going to try to be as non-racist as I possibly can. But there's a, you know, ultimately, Caucasians look at minorities as useful people. They like us when we're doing stuff for them, when we're cooking their food, when we're pumping their gas, when we're mowing their lawn. They like us. They appreciate us. But then once they lose sight of the value that we provide to them, then it's suddenly like, oh, you're a, you know, you're a waste. You're a whatever, a cancer on society. You know, blah 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 blah. And I've lived with that. I literally have lived with that where I've always lived in white neighborhoods. I've never lived in like any, you know, low rent neighborhoods anywhere that I've ever lived. And yeah, it's like when you're able to do something for people, they absolutely love you. They'll go to bat for you. I mean, just like, you know, the first two acts of this movie, everybody loves Edward. He can cut hair. He can style dog's fur. He can, you know, do the hedges. You know, when he can provide a service, they love him. As soon as people lose that value and they don't see the service that he can provide anymore, now he's a cancer on society. Now he's a danger to our children, blah, blah, blah. And it's like,
well, it turns so quickly.
It really does, like on a dime. And I'm sorry, but there's multiple characters in this movie who would be very problematic today. And obviously the first person I have to bring up is Joyce. I mean, you know, Joyce, she starts the movie out as just this kind of silly, horny housewife who's constantly trying to cheat on her husband, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But then she turns into a sexual predator and then fucking turns it around and accuses him of sexual assault. And you have to understand, I have a friend back in Connecticut who was accused of rape. He obviously didn't do it. He spent 2.5 fucking years in jail because this woman lied. So I have the kind of this love-hate relationship with both this movie and how can I put this without sounding?
Well, I know what you're going for, Venom, but like I think this movie, like I think it was almost even like showcasing the thing. Like I don't think it was. I really don't think it was. What's the word that I'm looking for? Emphasizing. Like, or putting a spotlight on, or, you know, trying to hide these things. I think it was trying to showcase what's really going on. Like, for example, like, I mean, you could even, today, like, when he, you know, when Anthony Michael Hall, is it his name, Jim in the movie, has him break into his parents' house.
Right.
And then, and when he comes out, and, you know, all the guns are on him, and, you know, like, he's got the knives for, like, obviously, that makes him different. You know, like, so, like, you can relate that to race as well. Like, so, you know, the things that have happened, like, in this scene, like, I don't know, maybe I was more emotional this time as opposed to, like, watching it in the 90s because of everything that's been going on. Yeah. And
yeah, it seems, you know, like, more relevant today. It's crazy.
But
right?
I feel like it was showing us these things that, like, I mean, because...
I think so.
You know,
for sure.
Edward doesn't just represent, you know, I think he represents different variations of, you know... our culture.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he can represent minorities, foreigners, you know, because like I said, there's themes in this movie of racism, classism, xenophobia, and which obviously back in 1990 weren't as big a deal. They were looked at more as comedic, you know, aspects. So
what's xenophobia? Is that fear of xenomorphs? I don't know what that is. I've heard that, but I don't know.
It's a fear of foreigners.
Okay.
Like, also people with disabilities.
Yes,
exactly, yes.
That see, and that's a big thing, too. And, you know, you said the whole sexual assault thing. She literally said he practically raped. Like, they say it in the movie.
Yeah.
So I think that, yeah, you're both correct, though. I think that it's definitely more relevant today. But I think it was probably relevant then, for sure. These same things have been going on.
People just look past it. Like, I don't think people have this conversation.
I'll be honest with you. I did not know that this movie was going to fucking say some shit. Like, I didn't expect it. And I'm like, okay. And see, and that's one thing, too. You know, you talk about Tim Burton's style visually, but there are certain aspects of his storytelling and just kind of the I wouldn't even call it subtlety, but just saying something without saying it. And it's very kind of black and white, and it's not like it's super deep. But at the same time, if you kind of hold that thought and run it concurrently with the movie, where it takes the character and all these things, man, you really can apply a lot to it. And it's you know, even as vague as just like feeling like you're an outsider, period. Like, just period. And I don't know, there's just something about this movie that's extremely relatable. And like, it also shows how a lot of people can just be absolute shitheads. Yeah.
See, I think this is by far Tim Burton's most important movie that he's ever made.
Yeah.
You know, obviously it's original. It has context. It's not just trying to be funny. Like, you know, there's a tone throughout the whole movie.
But baby, what other movie has penguins with missiles?
You should see my face.
I'm just kidding.
No, but I mean, I'm sorry. Like, you just feel it the entire time. Like, from the moment Johnny Depp graces the screen as Edward, like, you just, like, feel with him.
Automatically.
It's like you're with it. Like you said, you're watching him the entire time.
Right.
Like, for example, when, you know, Winona Ryder comes home early from the camping trip and, you know, he's in the waterbed. And, you know, she comes in, she goes into her room, and she's looking in the mirror, whatever, and you just see him in the bed. You're not looking at her at all. You're, like, literally looking in the mirror to look at him. That's a perfect example of just watching him.
Right.
Like, you want to see what he's going to do next. Like, everything else is secondary.
Yes.
And it just, you know, and the look on his face when he's laying in that bed and, like, she sees him. And, you know, then he pops the water. But I just love it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean.
And even even with those themes that we've already talked about, there's even more in here. I mean, there's elements of loneliness. There's elements of mental health. You know, this movie literally has so many fucking layers that you can peel back and talk about. I mean, I swear to God, we could talk about this movie for 4 hours. I'll try not to, obviously, but yeah, I mean, there is so, like I said, this movie is thick with social commentary, and for a 1990 movie, that's saying a lot. Not to say that there wasn't as much social commentary then as now, but this movie is so full of it that you would almost think it's a 2020 movie.
Right. And while I was watching it too, you know, in terms of the comedy and stuff like that, I was definitely laughing a lot. But in terms of the emotional aspect of it, you know, there was something that happened, you know, which is whatever. It happens sometimes when people watch movies where he cut himself on his face. Now, initially, I laughed and you go, aw. And like, you know, you were like genuinely sad by it. And I was just like, okay, whatever. Like, it didn't register to me, really, like, why that was really that sad. Like, he cut himself, like, whatever. But then that's a theme, and he does it several times, and, like, and you know, she's helping him
cover up his scars.
Like, it's so beautiful when you think about it. And, yeah, by the end, like, I felt bad for laughing, like, in the beginning. You know, because that had to do with more so me not knowing exactly what the tone was going in. And once it kind of settles in and you do realize that you're not only just getting wacky Tim Burton here, like, there's definitely some emotional stuff going on that I completely felt for it, to where when he did it for the rest of the movie, I subsequently with you at the same time went, aw.
Yeah, well, and I mean, that brings up another, you know, thing is, you know, she brought him down and she was trying, like, she, right away, you know, she's trying to put makeup on him and, you know, kind of hide who he really is. You know, she's trying to put him in normal people clothes.
Right.
You know, like, she's trying to change him. And, you know, obviously, like, I feel like her character, Diane Weiss' character, grew as well.
Right.
Throughout the movie. And, you know, when you talk about him cutting himself, like, it really comes full circle when, you know, rest in peace, Vincent Price. It's one of the most emotional scenes in a movie for me is, you know, when he was like, now, Edward, I know it's not Christmas quite yet, but I have a little early Christmas gift for you. And, you know, he has, and this is why he's incomplete, is because he died when he was going to give him his hand.
Oh.
And he's standing there and, like, somehow, like, it's like his body, like, pushed forward onto, you know, the scissors, and the hands broke, so, like, there was no way he could ever get them. And then he's so sad. And then how he cut his face And then, you know, he's been doing that throughout the whole movie.
Right.
And he goes down and, like, he's trying to help, you know, his creator.
Yep.
And he, you know, cuts his face as, like, he's trying to touch him.
Right.
And, you know, that's why he could never be, you know, normal without the hands.
Right. So it makes him unique, they said, you know?
Yeah. And that's another thing is, like, when he goes on to TV, they were like, well, she was like, I might know a doctor that, you know, can help you or whatever. Right. And then the next bitch comes in and she's like, yeah, but if they fixed you, then that wouldn't make you special and you wouldn't be on TV. Like, okay, well, obviously you guys turn on him in about a matter of 5 minutes.
Right.
So does he really need to be special?
Right.
Or, I mean, does he really need, like, any of you?
Exactly. Right.
I mean, feeling special is something that's kind of on the individual. You know, obviously I don't consider myself special in any way, but when I think about myself, I have that confidence. You know, I have a confidence in myself. I have confidence in the things that I do, so I feel like I'm special. Even though, ultimately, there's nothing special about me. I, you know, I don't have a handicap.
I would
I don't have an extra nipple
that.
Or
I
nothing.
No, I would completely disagree with that, sir. No,
yeah, you've got your girlfriend Pantera tickets.
Yeah. Right?
That's very special, isn't it? Kind of like the Olympics.
No, and I do want to say, though, that, okay, so if I initially watched this, like, you know, when it was released, I would not know or probably care who Vincent Price is. Obviously, since then, you know, I've picked up a fucking trick or two, and I've seen a couple movies. I gotta be honest with you, though. Everything that I have seen him in was way before the 90s.
Yes.
So seeing him in a movie with Johnny Depp, I'll be honest with you. I never knew that those two human beings coexisted and were in a movie together and, you know, shared the screen. There was something so magical about those scenes that, like, I could tell what they were doing right from the jump when they went back, you know, what did they go back twice, I believe?
Yeah.
And those scenes are just so important to the movie and so heartfelt.
He learned how to smile.
Yeah.
He's like, it's okay. Like, because he's learning how to, he's like teaching him things.
Dude, that's an actor. Like, and that's what I mean. Like, just in that scene, he, oh my God, he's.
You're here. They didn't hurt you, did they? Were you scared? I tried to make Jim go back, but you can't make Jim do anything. Thank you for not telling them that we...
You're welcome.
It must have been awful when they told you whose house it was.
I knew it was Jim's house.
You did?
Yes.
Well, then why'd you do it?
Because you asked me to.
So
well,
good.
Well, that and, you know, a lot of the, you know, the town people, suburban people, undermined his intelligence.
Right.
Completely, because, you know, especially Anthony Michael Hall's character, who was like, no, he can't know that this is my house or whatever, you know. But then, like, after he gets arrested and he comes back and he was like, I knew it was Jim's house.
Right.
And she
he
like,
knows.
And she was like, you did? Then why did you do it? And he goes, because you asked
me
to.
Yep.
And, like,
that's
I
the scene
just,
that
like,
gets me.
Yes.
Gets me
like,
every time.
You could just feel how much he loved her. And, like, I want to go back to the TV part for a
oh.
second. When they're asking him, do you have a special girl in your life? It literally felt like she knew he was looking like at her through the TV.
They felt like they were in the same room.
Yeah, let's talk about their relationship.
I'll be honest with you, like I knew that it was like a thing going in, like I knew that they got together or whatever. I really had no idea though. And so when the story kind of played out, I think it's one of the most beautiful relationships in any movie ever. Like I thought it was so kind of innocent and with him just, like you said, not being naive, but just basically being a good person because that's all he knew, whatever. He hasn't been corrupted by the fucking world. You know, he's not like this mob where they're all fucking shit people, basically, and like Venom said, using them and using people for things or whatever. You know, he's just a good person. And I don't know, man, this movie got me. You know, I was kind of withholding my feelings or at least vocalizing them to Lacey Liu. But damn, like, this movie actually got me about halfway through. And I'm like, all right, if this movie, you know, completely just fucks itself over in the last act or whatever, it's a 5 for me. And honestly, the last act, and we'll get into it, obviously, but that ending, like, I watched this, what, like a day and a half ago? I've been thinking about this movie ever since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he literally messaged me. He was just like, baby. Edward Scissorhands. This is like 15 hours after we watched it. He's like, I'm just thinking about it. What did you think of their relationship, Venom?
It's a weird one. I mean, obviously, Edward, it was pretty much love at first sight. As soon as Edward saw the picture of Winona Ryder's character, and you know, when he first got to the house, you could see the look on his face. I mean, it probably was one of the first women he's probably ever laid eyes on. So.
Right.
Besides Avon Lady.
Besides Avon Lady, yes.
Right.
But yeah, it's definitely got that puppy dog feel to it, that kind of puppy love thing.
Yeah.
Where you're not sure if it's love or if it's just an infatuation or whatever. But it definitely, as the movie goes along, especially on Winona's part, you definitely can see the love building. And even though they could never have a relationship ultimately, I mean, Edward's not really a real person. It would be exceedingly difficult for them to have, you know, any kind of relationship, and obviously reproducing is completely out, but it is a sweet, sweet little relationship. I still, the older I get, the bigger the thorn in my side gets, though, about Winona and the break-in scene. The fact that she, I mean, yeah, she's vocal about wanting to stop it, but I just feel like, why would you even... Like, I don't know, why would you even entertain the thought of taking advantage of this poor guy? I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me. Literally, just as you're starting to develop feelings for him, even if it's not love, even if it's just more respect or pity or sympathy, whatever it is, to actually go ahead and allow him to be a part of that crime, that's always been a big thorn in my side. And when they finally, when they have their first hug, it's a very emotional scene. But like I said, the older I get, the bigger that thorn in my side gets, because it's like, that bitch almost sent you to jail, and now you're hugging her. You know what I mean?
Well, but that's that probably was, what I mean. That, you know, little Rusty Griswold was pretty fucking pushy. And I feel like he would be like a woman abuser, like a wife beater, like he, you know, like I did not expect little Rusty Griswold to grow up to be that.
Nick Papa Giorgio.
Anthony Michael Hall plays a spectacular douchebag.
I've never seen him in a role like that. That's crazy.
Oh, he's played a few of those, yeah.
Oh, has he? Yeah.
He did it in Community, like, yeah, oh, the yeah. whole thing.
Okay, right on.
But yeah, in the 80s, he definitely, like Lacey said, definitely more the lovable nerd, the goofball, the comic relief in a lot of movies. Right. But it seems like as he got older, he got more buff, he got in better shape, and suddenly people were giving him those kind of roles, the bully, the douchebag, the asshole, whatever. And for whatever it's worth, he did a good job. I mean, I would never sit here and say Anthony Michael Hall is a great actor.
Right.
But he knows his roles well, and he does them well. So I'll give him credit for that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I agree. I didn't think he was anything spectacular, but at the same time, man, he definitely did a great job, because
you hated him.
I fucking hate him, dude. Like, I hate him so much in this movie. Like, and let's talk about that, because between those two characters and where it kind of ends up at the end, things get really dark in this movie. You know, what's this movie rated? It's got to be PG-13, right?
Yeah.
Yes, PG-13.
Okay. And I just thought that, like, I'll be honest with you, I did not expect it to have kind of, I don't know how to word it, but that edge to it. You know, I didn't think it was going to involve murder.
Well, it's true. I mean, especially at this time for Tim Burton, you don't expect one of his movies to end with a murder. So, yeah.
Right. Exactly.
And you didn't expect, like, okay, so we have to build up to, you know, Edward's frustration before we can just skip to murder.
Right.
You know?
Right. Exactly.
You know, because, like, obviously, like, he's trying to deal with his emotions.
Yep.
And obviously, like, he's feeling love and, like, obviously hate. And, like, he obviously hates, you know, Anthony Michael Hall, which we obviously do, too.
Right, right.
And you see it the first time when he, you know, ruins the wallpaper. And that's his first bit of anger. And then Alan Arkin's like, well, we're going to have to figure out how you're going to replace the, you know, wallpaper and everything else.
Yeah.
You can just, like, feel his anger, like, building. So, like, you know this is not the right place for him to be.
Right.
Because it's not going to end well. Like,
he's never been taught how to deal with this. He hasn't interacted with anybody.
Well, I mean, he's obviously not of this earth either, so.
Right. Exactly. Right. He's not a person. Yeah, I actually kind of forget that sometimes. Yeah, he's
Very lifelike, yes.
Right.
And, I mean, he has a heart and all of that. Which, I mean, it kind of sounds like, how did he actually, like, construct a human, or construct Edward?
I wonder that, but you know what?
Why didn't he just give him, why did he not just give him hands to begin with?
Right.
Because then we wouldn't have Edward Scissorhands. But, yes, you can definitely feel, like, his anger building.
For sure.
And then when, at the end, you know, he rips off his clothes.
I love that scene, but
when he's cutting off, when he's cutting off his, you
that
know.
That is a spectacular scene, because it shows that Edward, he no longer wants to play the role. He's incredibly happy with who he is, and he accepts his role. He accepts that he's going to be that weird guy that lives up on the hill by himself. And I love that confidence. Once again, when he's tearing those things off, he's not doing it in a sad way. He's angry.
No.
Right.
And I love that.
He's like, fuck these people.
And then
my favorite part is when he's like, fuck these people that took advantage of him.
Right.
He takes off the leg of the hedge that he trimmed, and, you know, the fat bitch, like, right away, she goes, I'm calling the police!
From Two and a Half Men, and Mr. Deeds.
Is that her?
Yeah.
She just passed away.
I know.
But rest in peace. I shouldn't probably call her fat bitch.
No.
But she was a fat bitch in this movie.
Yeah. Okay. No, she was pretty fucking horrible, along with everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, she turned on him, like, they all, after, like, what happened with him and Joyce, like,
and then
we haven't even touched on the religion of that crazy coup.
When
she's playing the accordion or, like, piano thing called, like, okay, and it's just like, like, I can't do, like, the music. He fucks with her because, like, she's hated him, like, ever since he got into town, and, like, she goes and opens the window and it's a fucking, he made a hedge of a devil.
That is one of my most one of my favorite guilty pleasure scenes in this movie because of what he does to this woman. The problem I've always had with that scene, though, is that Edward doesn't know religion. He's never been exposed to it. So I always wondered, how did he know that? How does he even know what a devil is? Like, obviously he heard Esmeralda say he's sent from the devil, blah, blah, blah. But I would have loved to have seen just one quick little scene where Edward maybe flips to a Bible or something. Or a picture book.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. It's a minor nitpick. It's not like it affects the scene, really. It's just, obviously, as I get older, you know, I start getting more analytical with my movies. But it's still, I mean, even today when I watched it for the 180th time, I still laughed out loud when she opened the window. Right. I fucking love that.
And I think though, without, you know, I'll give it a pass because of this, basically, because, you know, you see him in enough scenes with a bunch of different characters, whether he's trimming their hedges and this, that, and the other thing, that you feel like he's been around the neighborhood a little bit. Maybe he picked up on some stuff along the way. So while we didn't see that scene, like, I can kind of imagine maybe him seeing something. But I know what you're saying. Like, I want to see that. Like, show us that.
They could have done like one scene during Halloween where Edward sees a kid in a devil costume. Maybe.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, they could have done, like, a seasonal thing for sure.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
But, like I said, minor nitpick ultimately does not affect my enjoyment at all.
Just another one of the characters that, like, he had to deal with. And, like, I mean, it really does come full circle because, you know, the handicapped dude that was, you know, came up to him at the barbecue, he was like, don't ever let them tell you that you have a disability or whatever. And then, you know, when Kevin, the little kid, is walking home before, like, the main scene takes us into our climax, and he says to the kid, he's like, they catch that crippled. You know, and it's just like, wow, these people are so fake. The movie's just so heartbreaking, like, because that's how people really are, though. Like, they say one thing to your face and then say something completely different behind your back.
Right.
And this whole town, like, embodies it. Like, that opening sequence of when she's driving him into town for the first time and they, like, such nosy people. And they're all on the thread. Oh, I'll meet you at the end of the street. I'll meet you at the end of the street. Like, I know women like this.
Right.
Like, the moment anything happens.
And those type of things make this big world feel very small, you know?
Yeah.
Because small minds, and it's like a hive mentality, and it's all very negative. So, yeah, I got those vibes with a lot of those scenes as well. Again, you can look at it social commentary in a broad sense with society, or even on a minimalistic sense, you were just talking about, where we all know people like that, that gossip like that, that, you know, news literally travels like quicker than the car does to get to the house, you know?
Right.
I hear you, yeah. And speaking of that scene where she drives Edward down from the hill for the first time, a little piece of trivia for you. Did you guys notice the little blonde kid who uses the slip and slide as they drive by?
I did notice the slip and slide. No, who was it?
That little blonde kid is Nick Carter from the Backstreet Boys.
What?
Yeah, no? Nick Carter is from Tampa, and apparently he lived in that neighborhood, and Tim Burton was like...
Florida.
So weird. Yep. That's so weird because me and Lacey Lou are avid watchers and fans of The Masked Singer.
We're pretty convinced.
Yeah, we've been trying to guess this one guy, and so we've been listening to a lot of Backstreet Boys trying to match the voice. So we've been playing a lot of Backstreet. I swear, that's what I've been telling people anyways about him. No, but we've been listening, so that's weird that he's in this movie.
Like,
that's crazy.
I was like, this sounds like Nick Carter. And so we were playing the music trying to match, and it does sound like, we're pretty convinced it's Nick Carter.
See, but that sounds like one of those Wonder Year Paul Marilyn Manson sucks his own dick stories. Like, it's like, there's no way that Nick Carter, but that's awesome.
Yeah, no, I feel like that's confirmation that it is Nick Carter on The Masked Singer. The fact
that is,
I'm just
right?
brought that up. Why else?
Why else? Exactly.
It makes even more sense to me.
Everybody.
Yeah, see, we're all on the same wavelength.
Right?
Yeah.
So when we get into the climax of our film, you know, we kind of jumped ahead, but I want to talk about, like, my favorite scene of the movie.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, before she goes, hold me, I can't. You know, we talked about that already, but we didn't say the lyrics or the quote, so I had to go back. So she hears him cutting. Like, I love how, like, you can just hear him snip.
Right.
And it's like the ice shavings are coming off of whatever he's sculpting for the Christmas party.
Yep.
And she goes out and she's in the white dress. And I'm sorry, I think this is the best she's looked in any film ever.
Yeah.
And I think this is the best look. She does look good in, you know, Heathers and whatnot. I
thought she looked odd as a blonde. I prefer her as a brunette.
I don't know. I loved it. I thought she looked beautiful. I don't know. Maybe it's the white
dress.
She looks
great. Oh, don't get me wrong. I'm not taking anything away from her.
Oh, I didn't think that.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Something about her natural dark hair always worked for me. She's got those big brown eyes. Yeah. I don't know.
And let's talk about that scene, too, because that obviously highlights one of the bigger things of this movie, who's always been there with Tim Burton, but man, fucking Danny Elfman, dude. He crushes this movie.
From the very first note of this film, you can feel the stink of Danny Elfman all over it. It's amazing.
Yep.
You know, I mean, Danny Elfman is half the reason that Tim Burton's movies feel like dreams, like, you know, dream states, or, you know, like fantastical. It's that music. I mean, sometimes, you know, it's kind of fast-paced and happy, almost like a 70s sitcom, but then other times it's just so somber, and it adds a level of sadness to those scenes. Lacey, you're right. The music playing during that scene when Winona is dancing under the snow is stellar. It's amazing.
Yep.
Elfman and Burton together, I mean, it's peanut butter and chocolate all over again. Fucking love it.
Yeah, no, I don't know. There's just something about it that just feels so transcendent or translucent. I don't know what the word I'm... Like, it just feels so, like, whimsical and magical. And,
right.
you know, like, he's creating the snow for her. Right. And, like, because obviously, like, there's snow doesn't exist there, and, like, it's a special moment.
Right.
And it's one of the most iconic moments in cinematic history.
And you know, it's funny, too, because everybody obviously has different tastes, and those tastes change. But I know, like, with a movie like this, I'm into a lot of different things, whether it be Star Wars. I know Venom, you too. Like, so many different stories or whatever. But there's something about just being very simplistic. And in doing that, you can really say a lot, you know, kind of without saying it. And I think that this movie works on so many different levels that scene, in correlation with the music, like we said, and like you were just talking about, it adds such a layer to where I think that it doesn't work without everything, you know, flowing.
Every component.
If you're not, you know, doing it visually like Burton was doing, and you know, you're seeing that image of him, you know, like you said, dicing at it, and with Elfman's score, it's just one of my favorite things in movies. You know, those moments, I feel like they have to be earned. When you have that moment and then you kind of crush it the way, you know, they did in this movie, I just think it just, man, like, what a great aspect of this movie that, like, I don't know, I just really felt it, you know? I don't know, there was something about going in where, hey, Edward Scissorhands, but, like, I had no idea what I was getting into. Like, I had no idea it was going to be like that, and I was ridiculously pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. Like I said, I've been a fan of this movie since day one. It's almost perfect. I mean, every aspect of this movie, the score, set design, performances, writing, editing, cinematography, pacing, just about every aspect of this movie is near flawless. So,
right.
I mean, it's really hard for me to even find, because I always try to bring something to nitpick about my movies. But when they're
right.
almost perfect, it, you know, and don't get me wrong, it's not like I'm complaining that I couldn't find anything to bitch about, but it's just such a rare treat that a movie is this well received and has stood the test of time. I mean, this is a 30-year-old movie now, and it still rings just as true as it did in 1990. So this is going to go down in cinematic history. This is going to be a movie that people will watch for hundreds of years to come, and I think it'll never like lose its appeal, you know. As time goes by, new fans are gonna watch it, like Mr. Dan Chase, and you know,
yes.
and learn about, you know, the amazing quality of this thing, the early filmmaking of Tim Burton, which we may never see again. So anytime
I
can,
do.
Oh, I really hope we do. I mean. He's currently writing Beetlejuice 2, so fingers crossed, because that's literally his only project he's working on right now. So he's putting 100% of his attention on Beetlejuice 2. So fingers crossed that we get at least half the movie that we got, you know, back in 89.
Do you think by the time that comes out, Winona's going to look like she did in the old lady makeup in this? You know, I think I can do her voice as the old lady.
Oh, do it.
Hang on. Well, you see, before he came down here. Oh, I just dropped my water. before he came down here, it never snowed.
That was good, yes. Yes.
I believe he is. You see, before he came down here, it never snowed. And afterwards, it did. Up there now, I don't think it would be snowing. Sometimes you can still catch me dancing in it.
Oh. let's get into life before that happened. All right, so obviously when he does accidentally like nick the, you know, like the kid, or, you know, Winona, like the mom is always quick to say, she's like, oh, it was just a little scratch,
right?
Like, she's very, you know, like, I feel like the good people in this are like so far and few between. Like, there's not so many good people in this movie, as there's like, it just shows you like how many, like at that end scene when the whole town is there,
right,
that all turned on him. There's only like several people that like really had his back at the end of the day. I think that kind of speaks like of how people really are.
Do you think that she's naive or more like progressive?
No, I think her character grew.
Yeah.
No, I think I honestly, Peg to me is the most likable person in this movie.
Right.
And
right,
she probably knows Ed more than anyone. She knows that he doesn't have an evil bone in his body.
You mean Edward?
Right. Edward, yes, I'm sorry. Oh, he prefers Edward, doesn't he? But yes, I mean, she understands that every time somebody gets nicked by his scissors, she's always the first to come to his defense. Right. Even when he got arrested, she knew he didn't do anything purposely illegal. She knew that somebody had to have gotten into his head or put the idea in there, whatever. So I'll give Diane Wiest and Peg all the credit in the world. They are... She is the most likable person in this movie.
Yep, I would totally agree with that for sure.
Aside from Edward, yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, obviously, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, you know, and obviously, like, so he kind of gets chased out of town and back into, you know, where he came from. Mm-hmm. But I think he knew, like, he was going to have to go back there anyway, because he accidentally, like, cuts Anthony Michael Hall, and then Winona looks at him and she goes, run! And, you know, he just takes off running, and... You know, it's the same cop that dealt with him when he got arrested. And, you know, like, obviously, you're wondering why the cop isn't catching up next to him in the cop car.
Right.
And then it all makes sense. Like, there was a rhyme and reason for it.
Yeah.
The cop obviously had sympathy for him.
Totally.
You know, because he's asking the doctor when he got arrested. He was like, is he going to be all right out there? And he goes, yep. The doctor's like, oh, yeah, whatever. You know, like, he really wasn't like.
Hate this guy.
Just think if she said run and it was Tom Hanks. That would
with his tiny little legs.
Run, Edward, run.
No, but I do like, though, how that whole scene went down with the cop and everything. Because here's the thing. Like you guys said, he's not a real fucking person. So how is this going to really play out? And I think that that plays to the tragic aspect of the story, obviously. But it also provides, like, a logistical, like, yeah, that makes sense. And that kind of sucks on a whole other level, too. Like, damn, that's reality. Like, that's pretty much how reality would be, you know? Especially to protect him, obviously, like, and that's what she was doing. But yeah, man, what a way to kind of wrap everything up on a logistical sense, and then have.
What do you mean logistical?
Well, like, okay,
not logistical at all.
That way he can stay around, mm-hmm, and he can make dinosaurs up at his place. He definitely
murdered someone.
He upgraded his place, though.
To
he
where,
was happier.
But baby,
he had a nice garden.
I'm sorry. I'm completely got to disagree. Yes, he had a nice garden.
He had a secret garden.
Yes, however.
Secret
however,
window.
You don't think that they're going to go after him after he killed, after a rich kid from the suburbs died?
But that's what I'm saying. That's why I like it. It's because, logistically speaking, she says, no, he's dead. The fucking
so they didn't go look for him?
Yes, that's what I meant. Yeah, so obviously they can't be together because, like we said, they're not human. But that provides a thing where, hey, we can keep Edward alive. He's right up the fucking hill. You know, he's blooming flowers now.
He's making it snow.
His place looks dope, and he's making it snow for everyone. Like, I just, I like I said, it not only works on a logistical sense, but it's kind of the heart of the movie, too. You know,
absolutely,
in a lot of ways.
Well, and I don't really feel like Edward honestly murdered anybody, like, because it was
no,
self-defense.
No.
So, I mean, you never hear what actually happened after all that. Like,
I feel like when all the townspeople rolled up and they saw Anthony Michael Hall, like, they didn't have to ask questions. They're like, yeah, that guy's a dick. Like, they're all dicks, but they're like, yeah, he's the dickish.
Well, yeah, and that's why when the cop, you know, like, puts the gun and bullets in the air.
Right,
like,
right.
It's hard to, like, it's so easy to separate the good from the bad people in
totally
this. Because,
yes,
like, he wasn't, like, after him.
Without a doubt.
And he's like, run, he's like, run, you know, like, the cop is letting him go as well. So, like,
it's, well, the cop fooled everybody as well, too. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
But
yeah,
I don't
and
believe
I
that
it.
The cop would have just, like, left with that big of a mob outside.
It was very, that scene reminded me of, like, a play, you know, like the Frankenstein mob and, like, everybody just goes home. And when everybody went home, it reminds me of, like, one of the Treehouse of Horror episodes with the Simpsons. You know, angry mob outside.
It reminded me of Halloween 4.
That too, yeah. Or any other Halloween movie with a mob, which is all.
Which Anthony Michael Hall is apparently leading the mob in Halloween Hills.
Yeah, what do you think of him playing Tommy Doyle, Venom?
You know what? I'm not ultra excited, but I'm... my fingers are crossed for him. I mean, I wish him nothing but luck. Because I want him to pull it off. I want to love that movie, you know? So obviously I really hope he can do it, but ultimately we don't really have a blueprint for an adult Tommy Doyle though, do we?
No.
So he's basically going to be setting the standard. So
absolutely.
As long as he doesn't completely fuck it up, I'm sure he'll do fine.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely.
And even if he does fuck it up, I tend to blame directors more than actors, because ultimately the director is the one that gets the performance out of his actors.
Absolutely.
And even though, you know, we like to say that, you know, this person can't act or that person can't act, it's like, well, you know, how come some actors look brilliant in some movies and then they look idiotic in others? It's because of the director. So,
I saw enough good stuff in that first one that I'm at least hopeful to see.
Yeah, I think it'll work better.
For sure.
Now, before we get into our final ratings, was there anything else you wanted to touch on this movie, Venom?
I mean, you know, I got a bunch of, you know, silly little trivia that I had written down. Not a lot of it's not really all that interesting. But, you know, and we've already talked about a bunch of it, you know, all the actors that were in the role before him. This is an obvious piece of trivia. We all know what 80s musician inspired Edward's hair, correct?
Michael Jackson.
Robert Smith of
Robert
the
Cure. Robert Smith from The Cure, right. Yeah. Yes.
Because, again, Tim Burton is a fan of The Cure. He saw Robert Smith's hairdo, and he thought that it made sense for someone like Edward, who's not really used to self, you know, self-care and hygiene and things like that. So he went ahead and went with that. Johnny Depp had to go through 2 hours of makeup every day for a 40-day shoot for this movie. The suit that he was wearing, even though it looked like it was leather and like fake leather, it was actually made of a lot of duct tape. And actually, part of it was made from an old couch that Tim Burton had, an old black couch that he had. He basically just cut like sections of it out and turned it into the costume.
He was just looking at that couch and he's like, I want that around Johnny Depp or Jim Carrey or
Tom Cruise.
Yeah, Tom Hanks. Yeah.
Unfortunately, because of the makeup of the costume, Johnny Depp couldn't film for more than like 40 minutes at a time. Because don't forget, they're shooting outdoors in Tampa, Florida in the middle of the summer. Johnny actually passed out a couple of times from heat exposure or, you know, heat stroke. And obviously they would have to, you know, halt the production for a little bit to get him back to where he needed to be. Because they shot in Florida, they also had to halt production multiple times because of insect swarms. Basically, I'm sure you may have noticed how in some of the scenes, the clouds in the sky aren't consistent with the last shot. That's because they would be shooting, and there's actually footage of this online, where they would be shooting a scene, and literally it would look like thousands of, like, gnats and flies and everything else would just be in front of the camera. It literally looked like they were shooting, like, you know, in the middle of an infestation.
Well,
so they literally have to stop production, bring in exterminators to kill as many of them as possible, and then go back to shooting the scene, which explains why the sky doesn't always look consistent in every scene. So,
in one of the scenes, you can see one of those fumigation tents on the house, the same ones that Walter White and Jesse used to cook in. And later,
see that?
Yeah, you could see it in the movie, because I was like, oh, because it was almost like it looked like a circus tent thing around the house, and I was like, that's awfully fucking Tim Burton-y. I was like, what is that? But no, I'm pretty sure, I'm almost positive, especially because of the story that you just told me, that was a fumigation tent around the house for sure.
I believe it. Absolutely.
Yep.
Unfortunately, again, because of the costume, Johnny Depp vomited twice on set. The first time he vomited was the barbecue scene when all the women are feeding him all the desserts. They shot that scene six times, and because Johnny Depp was still a young actor, he didn't realize that he wasn't supposed to swallow all that food. So he actually ate all that shit that they were spoon-feeding him for like six or seven takes, and he ended up vomiting.
I think of the scene with Jim Carrey where they're feeding him the fudge.
Right.
Well, Jim Carrey didn't get this role, though, but he eventually got the same scene.
There you go. And then the other scene that made Johnny, vomit was the scene where he's running right at the end of the movie when he's running away from the cop and the cop's like chasing him to the gate of his property. They shot that scene six times, and because of the weight and the fact that the costume couldn't breathe as well as it could, first he passed out, then he vomited.
So,
Johnny Depp went through a lot for this role.
Shot the scene six times.
Yes. Wow.
Another Halloween reference.
We know.
And then the last thing that I wanted to talk about was just what I think the movie's main theme is. Now, mind you, listeners, this is my opinion and my opinion only. I feel like the main theme of this movie is conformity is terrifying. And what I mean by that is, for all of us who've lived in society our whole lives, conformity is easy. We know right from wrong. We know what we should do in certain situations, blah, blah, blah. But somebody like Edward Scissorhands, who, you know, basically was created and was in the process of being taught right from wrong by his creator, he's not 100% sure what is right and wrong. And the perfect scene that encapsulates this is the dinner scene when the dad gives him the options about what to do with the briefcase of money that he finds.
Right.
Ultimately, Johnny goes with the answer that he thinks is correct because, as Winona mentions, it's the nice thing to do. You find the money and you give it to your family. That kind of shows that conformity isn't, you know, the easiest thing for a lot of people. And I feel like by the end of the movie, especially, you know, we already talked about it, the scene where he tears all the clothes off, that's basically him giving a middle finger to conformity and basically saying, no, I am Edward Scissorhands. I'm going to be who I want to be. And a lot of people don't really take that from that scene, but I feel like that's an incredibly powerful message that Edward basically just looks at the face of society and conformity and says, no, I don't want this. I'm going home. And that's why I've always felt like that's the main theme here. Conformity is terrifying. And, you know.
And you can't blame him.
No. Oh, God, no. I mean, he was so happy by himself in his little castle. And then he, you know, he's kind of pulled out of it against his will, even though he did kind of go along because this
wait
is
a minute, wait a minute. I don't know how happy he was, but he was in the fucking attic in the corner.
Oh, maybe not when Peggy first showed up, definitely. But the car drive back, he has an ear-to-ear grin on his face. He's looking at all
like
the
you make it seem like it was Johnny Depp and Blow, and he had, you know, bitches in the back scissoring.
Yeah, but I think that, like, once he came down, like, I think it was good for him to come down and get some culture.
Yes.
Because he took that back with him, and, you know, like, obviously, he found things that made him happy.
Yeah, and it's like, this is a person that doesn't know any better. It's like a clean slate. So any imprint that society can have on someone, or try to in this case, and like you said, Venom, how he rejects it, I feel like that's such a relatable thing.
Right.
And like I said, you can look at it in a very broad sense or you know, in a very minute sense. But I don't know, man. I agree with everything Mr. Venom says. And also, too, one of the main things I like about how you podcast, Mr. Venom, is you speak in a way where you say the things that you may call as a nitpick, but you make it clear that clearly doesn't have
a bearing
on it. You're saying it is what it is. And I think that's so important. And people get caught up on, you know, we live in this society where it's like all about the blurb. And it's like, oh, this is my one liner to this movie or whatever. Like, we can say some fucking ruthless shit about movies. And like you said, it will have no bearing on you know, my likability of the movie whatsoever. And I think that, you know, this movie in particular, it's a perfect example of, like, you can maybe come up with a nitpicky thing here or there, but the things that are great about it are so much grander on so many more levels, and it's so deeper that anything nitpicky doesn't even fucking come close. You're not even talking about in the same league as some of the bigger themes that are kind of explored right here. So I don't know. I just, yeah, if anybody couldn't tell, I love this movie. Yeah,
it was a great conversation.
Yeah.
So what do you feel about this movie, Venom? What do you rate? Did your rating change by talking to us or on your rewatch?
No, not at all. I've thought the same thing about this movie as I've always have. It's a 5 out of 5 to me. I mean, there's, as I've said, all I can do is nitpick little things. Like, I can't look at this movie and say, that's wrong or that's wrong,
right?
You know? It's just little, you know, like the whole devil hedge thing or whatever. It's like little right, tiny little nitpicky stuff that didn't even affect me when I watched it in 1990. But obviously, as an adult and a podcaster, you know, you're a little bit more analytical with the way that you look at these films, and you notice little stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, to Dan's point about, you know, pointing out nitpicks and talking about how it doesn't necessarily affect my enjoyment, despite what some of my regular listeners might think, I don't like shitting on people's art. I genuinely don't. No matter how bad a movie is, someone put their blood, sweat, and tears into it, and you have to understand that. I mean, it sucks, yeah, but it's still somebody, that was somebody's baby. And even though it came out a little bit like a mongoloid, it's still someone's baby. So, you know, despite people hearing me shit on Black Christmas 2019 or Greta or Open House or whatever, I still don't enjoy shitting on someone's art. And, you know, I've spoken to multiple directors, actually, that I've given bad reviews to their films, and they kind of say the same thing that you said, Dan, that they appreciate that I list everything that I have wrong with the film. But I try to avoid statements like, this movie sucks, this movie's garbage. You know, I try to avoid statements like that, because that's ultimately, that's
constructive
subjective
criticism.
Exactly. Well,
absolutely.
Right. So,
now,
so yeah,
I have
I mean,
a question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, the listeners obviously don't know this, but actually we were going to do another movie called December, which was a newer one, but we kind of wanted to stick with the theme of keeping it to more classic movies. So we gave you a list of a few for you to choose from, like this one, like Ernest Saves Christmas, apparently Dan's Friday After Next.
Santa Claus jacked us, he raped us, robbed us, fucked us.
Okay. Now, what was it that made you pick this one?
Oh, honestly, it was just my experience with the film over the years. Because ultimately, all the movies you listed, I enjoy in some way, shape, or form. And Friday After Next would have been my second choice behind that. I genuinely love that movie. But Edward Scissorhands, like I said, it's a movie that is both fun, yet artistically beautiful. It's got masterful filmmaking. You know, the script is on point. The acting is nearly flawless. It's one of those things where I enjoy talking about movies when they're of a higher quality. And with
right.
And not to say that any of the other movies that you listed are necessarily quote unquote worse. I just have more fond memories with this movie, both when I was younger and over the last few years, because another little piece of trivia for you. This is one of the first movies Mrs. Venom and I ever watched together.
Oh,
yeah. So, yeah, I mean, so there's that better too, you know. Heather's, I think, is the other one. I think we had a Winona Ryder night, one of the first times we got together. And I think, and I think we might have done Beetlejuice, too, if I remember. But, yeah, I just, because of my personal relationship with both this film, Tim Burton, Johnny Depp over the years, it was a no-brainer for me to pick this one.
All right.
And what about you, Dan?
Yeah, I as you know, it's been no secret. I loved it. Here's the thing about it. I was like, yeah, no, that was great. That last scene really fucking got me. This movie is perfect. Everything that we talked about, I came to the conclusion that this movie's perfect. But then, after, like I said, gave it a day or so, and it takes a particular type of movie to kind of
creep,
get under my skin in the best way possible. And I just kept thinking about, you know, kind of the themes of it or whatever. And it just grew on me even more. So I thought I had hit the ceiling when I watched it. Like, this is a 5 or whatever. But, like, it exceeded that with time. I do love, you know, there's something about, you know, you have to know yourself, right? So you don't want to go into a movie and say, oh, this is a classic. Like, I'm supposed to like this movie, right? You know? I'm also not going to – I figured I'd probably fucking dig it because it was Burton in his prime.
And you're emo.
And I'm emo as fuck. You know how it goes, you know. And, you know, I love The Cure. But, no, it's just going into it and kind of developing your own – feelings, you know, whether it's unique from anybody else's or not, I don't know. But, like, I know that I felt something coming out of that movie, and I was like, man, that was really fucking solid. And you just don't get that with a lot of movies, and I definitely got it with this. And I like, you know, I think that this movie is definitely going to be added into the yearly Christmas rotation. So, yeah, 5. And then it went higher somehow. But 5, I loved it.
Yeah, see, for me, this movie came out when I was 3 years old.
Yep.
You know, I grew up watching this, like, all the time. You know, I don't know if anybody else, like, I don't remember, like, my friends ever, like, talking about it or, you know, I'm sure that they did. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember, like, anybody having, like, a passion for it, like, the way that I did.
Right.
You know, like, it's one of those movies, and I love the social commentary, and like, I guess a little bit of times you kind of feel like Edward. You know, I remember being outside when it was snowing and, like, imitating, you know, Winona doing her dance in there. Like, I don't know. I just remember these things about myself. Like, I would reenact my favorite scenes from movies, and this was one of them.
That's a great memory.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, nobody else was out there with me, but I just remember, like, I used to play Buffy by myself and slay vampires with pencils in my grandma's basement. You know, like, I there's so many, like, iconic, you know, movie moments for me, and that's this is one of them. And it's very near and dear to my heart, and you know, I feel like it helped kind of shape who I am with my love of film. And I think it's a perfect film. And you know, Johnny Depp, you've mentioned 6 other people, you know, that were supposed to play this role, but I believe he was born for this role. He is Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah.
He just embodied, like, his facial, like, I just, this.
Sorry,
this,
Tom Cruise.
This is Johnny Depp's role of, my personal favorite role of his. Like, yeah. I mean, I'm, like, getting choked up, like, talking about it. But, like, I mean, I just love it. Like, I used to watch this movie with my mom all the time and, like, my sister. It's just one of those. And it's perfect. You know, I mean, aside from, you know, the little thing where I think the cops probably would have investigating the rich kid getting killed. But I really love this movie. And thank you for the trivia on it, Venom. This was a really great, fun time.
Yeah, absolutely. Dude, definitely, man. Now, Mr. Venom, before we let you go, obviously, it's cut to the chase and we've come to the end. So it is that time to pimp your shit, you little ho-ho-ho.
All right, I'll try to be as fast as possible because I've gotten multiple complaints that I take too long with all the shows I watch. But my main thing is, of course, No More Room in Hell with Mr. Mike Merriman. We just recorded episode 26, where we looked at a couple of subterranean horror films. We looked at 1972's Raw Meat, also known as Deathline. And then we looked at 2004's Creep. That episode is currently available on the Dark Discussions podcast network. And then the side cast to No More Room in Hell is No More Room in Hell Presents Fresh Cuts, where we review the newest of the new horror films. On our last episode, we looked at the latest Spanish horror release that's currently available on Netflix called Don't Listen. That episode,
oh, I heard about that.
Yeah, we just recorded that one yesterday, so that one should be out tomorrow, also on the Dark Discussions podcast network. My kaiju podcast is Underwater Kaiju from Outer Space. I do that with Mr. Jerry Herring, Donna Nelly, and Boo Boo Bougie from Cinema Attack.
that's been underwater for a while.
It has.
When's the latest episode of that?
So, believe it or not, we are recording this Sunday. It's our triumphant return. We're going to be looking at my favorite Godzilla movie, which is 1995's Godzilla vs. Destoroyah. Just one of the most emotional Godzilla movies out there. Spoiler alert, it is the only movie where Godzilla dies. But there is a happy little post-credits scene. So people who've seen the movie know what I'm talking about. But yeah, it's definitely
one of the most... When you said Godzilla 1990, I got nervous for a second.
Oh, God, no.
I was like, oh, no. I was like, what do you mean?
No. I walked out of the theater for that movie. That and Mortal Kombat Annihilation are the last two movies that I walked out of the theater for.
Goodness, that CGI in that is fantastic.
Fucking awful. But that's Underwater Kaiju from Outer Space. That one is available on the Legion Podcast Network. That episode will probably be out later next week sometime. On In the Mic of Madness, that is another of my podcasts that was unfortunately on a long hiatus. We just got back. That is because the main host of that show, Rebecca Reinhart, is a jack of all trades in the horror community. She's a producer. She's an actress. She's even done catering. I mean, she's like I said, she's so... involved in independent horror. I think she currently has something like 6 to 8 projects that she's working on. But she finally got some time off. We were able to record an episode. But what we decided to do was, instead of actually reviewing a movie, we decided to just put together a fun little show. So what we did is the three of us put together our top 10 Spank Bank horror scenes. Yes, those 30-second nude scenes that we would rewind 12 times as a 13-year-old back in the 80s so we could do things to ourselves.
Was Black Swan on that list?
Which one?
Was Black Swan?
It is on mine.
I believe it was on Brad's list, yes.
Yes.
My list, unfortunately, because
I'm... Look at the big brain on Brad.
Because I'm such an old man, most of my list was 70s movies, but I feel like 70s horror is one of the trashiest decades ever. I mean, so much nudity. I mean, full frontal nudity, too, something we don't really get to see a lot of modern horror. Yeah, 70s Bush all day.
I hadn't seen a bush in a long time, and then all of a sudden Alison Brie popped in with a horse.
She came in hot with that fucking
with her
thing.
Bush, yeah.
Nice.
I was like, what do you mean Alison Brie has a bush?
That made me want to scream. Wow. I don't know what's
going on. So anyway, that is the latest episode of In the Mic of Madness. That one is available on the Prescribed Films Podcast Network. And then the last one that I'll talk about today is It's Not Horror, Okay?
Hey.
That is a movie commentary podcast that I do with Mr. Neil Lemoy and Heather and Scott from the Friday Nightmares podcast. On the last episode, we looked at 1981's Kill and Kill Again, which is a South African martial arts movie. It is the sequel to 1980's Kill or Be Killed. And so that was a fun little commentary. Anybody who hasn't listened to that show, these commentaries are barely commentaries. It's really just four drunk idiots talking shit to each other. So if you're into just, you know, listening to four drunk, dumb people talk shit, then yeah, check out It's Not Horror, Okay? That one is available on the Dark Discussions Podcast Network. And then I have one guest spot that I did recently on the 22 Shots of Moods and Horror podcast. I joined them as part of the Italian Horror Month celebration. We took a look at three films by Mr. Alberto Di Martino. Those three films were The Killer is on the Phone, starring Telly Savalas, Holocaust 2000, and which is also known as The Chosen in America, and then The Antichrist. All three movies, like I said, from Mr. Alberto Di Martino. And of course, you know, 22 Shots is always a fun time. You know, I love making fun of JP and Jeremy, so yeah, I relish my guest spots there. And that's really all I have for you so right now. At least, you know, I don't want to bore your listeners anymore than I already have.
Well, let me tell you something, Mr. Venom. We relish your guest spots here every year for Christmas.
Yeah.
This is a great tradition that I think...
we're going to keep.
We're definitely going to carry on in the future,
but
sir.
But let's have him on again sooner.
Yes, for sure. For sure.
Yes, don't make me wait a year. I love you guys.
Yes.
We'll talk to you, whether it's podcasting or off the air. You guys are always a blast. I relish our time together. So, yeah, definitely don't make me wait a year.
No, and the feelings are mutual, my friend. 100%. Absolutely.
Well, let's jingle ball this out and peace out.
E-Town down! Ho, ho, ho!
Merry Christmas, everybody.